I call the Senate Resources Committee to order. Today's Friday, January 26, 2023. The time is 3:30 p.m. Please silence all cell phones. Present today are Co-Chair Giesel, Vice Chair Willikowski is away on other state business. Senator Klain is here. Senator Dunbar is here. Senator Kaufman is in another meeting. We'll be joining us shortly. Senator Kawasaki is here. Myself, Senator Bishop. So today we want to thank our staff. Carrie Cooper Ryder, good afternoon. It used to be morning. I have to reprogram myself here. Miss Lisa Denny back here on comms. Today's agenda, SB 10, hunting, trapping, fishing, and disabled vets. And then we're going to have a presentation by our commissioner in person on the Yukon and Kuskokwim fisheries from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We're going to roll into SB 10. We're just going to have an overview. We're going to hear and hold the bill, and Senator Keel and Ms. Slinghide, staff to Senator Keel, will be here to walk us through this bill. So, and Senator Kaufman is here. Senator Keel, welcome. Ms. Slinghide, welcome, and please start. And I'm assuming that Ms. Slinghide will do the sectional.
At the will of the chair.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Bishop, Co-Chair Giesel, members of the committee. Appreciate you hearing the bill today. My name is Jesse Keel. I have the privilege of representing Senate District B, where you all sit today. Thank you for being here. Senate Bill 10 is a bill that brings parity between a couple of license types and provides a benefit to Alaska's service-disabled veterans. When an Alaskan turns 60, under our current law, so some of you are coming up close on that. They are entitled to a – Senator Dunbar isn't close to that? I'm sorry. You're younger than you look. they are entitled
– Not a rearview mirror bill.
Mr. Chairman, a 60-year-old Alaskan is entitled to a lifetime hunting, fishing, and trapping license. For our service-disabled veterans, folks who were honorably discharged but incurred a service-related disability of 50% or more, under current law, they get a lifetime hunting and fishing license. We've done a lot of looking, done a lot of asking. No one can quite figure out why trapping was excluded when this was put into place. Senate Bill 10 makes those match. It adds trapping to a service-disabled veteran's lifetime license. Last year, in running this bill, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game asked us to add trapping to the annual, not lifetime, the annual free hunting and fishing license for current members of active duty members of the Alaska National Guard and the military reserves. I was happy to do so, very happy to do so. Mr. Chairman, that's what the bill does. It has support from a number of outdoor groups. It has support from a number of veteran service organizations. And I think for those, especially those who were injured in service to our nation, I never wore the uniform myself, but I think it's a very small token of our appreciation and respect. I'm happy to answer questions.
Questions from committee members on the bill sponsor. Senator Dunbar. Bree Fettes. Back on the record, I'd like to also recognize Rep. McCormick, I believe, is here in the audience back there in the – there you go. Hello, sir. I'd like to recognize him. He's new to the legislature from Bethel, so welcome, sir. Okay. No further – was there another – Senator Klain, did you have a question for Senator Keel? Did you – you started to grab your mic.
Only to comment about this 60 business that he was suggesting that everybody on the committee is under 60, and
yeah.
I wish I was. But okay. Other than that, no, I think it's a good bill.
Okay. Ms. Slinghide, would you like to walk us through the sectional, please, ma'am?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Kathy Slinghide, staff to Senator Keel. Sections 1 and 2 of the bill make conforming changes to a cross-reference. Section 3 adds a free trapping license for active duty National Guard and military reserves, and also makes a conforming change to remove service-disabled veterans from the free license statute. Section 4 makes service-disabled veterans who live in Alaska eligible for a free permanent ID for hunting, fishing, and trapping. Section 5 makes a conforming change to repeal and reenact language, and Section 6 adds an effective date.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, can you say your name again?
Mr. Chair, in response to Senator Dunbar, Kathy Schlinghide.
Ms. Schlinghide, through the chair, I wanted to ask you about the term active members of the Alaska National Guard and Military Reserve. So in the National Guard, there is something called the AGR, Active Guard Reserve Program, which are full-time, typically paid for by, they are paid for by Title X funds. Is that your intent here, or is it just a member who is currently a member of the National Guard that could be a traditional one weekend a month service member?
Mr. Chair, in response to Senator Dunbar's question, this is an existing definition in the statute, and it cross-references to a statute about mortgage eligibility for veterans, and so it defines in that statute that it's one weekend a month and 15 consecutive days a year.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. No further questions. We've got some invited testimony. I believe we're at Senator Kawasaki.
Thanks, and I don't know if you can answer this, but I don't have Title 18 in front of me, but this wouldn't prevent, if a person, this still requires a person to be a resident of the state of Alaska, and there are conditions for a person to become a resident, like a year residency. I know it's different for PFD, it's different for college, tuition, it's different for hunting and trapping and fishing licenses. Can you run through that and clarify? Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, in response to Senator Kawasaki, these are both for Alaska residents. We use the existing definitions of Alaska residency in the fish and game laws, so there would be no change to those under this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Last chance, further questions from committee members? Seeing none, I believe we're at this point, we're going to go to our invited testimony, and we're going to go first, thank you, and we're first going to go to Mr. John Sturgeon, President, Safari Club Alaska. Mr. Sturgeon, can you hear us, sir?
Good afternoon. This is, for the record, this is John Sturgeon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. Chairman Bishop, Co-Chair Giesel, and the rest of the Natural Resource Committee. I am the current president of Safari Club Alaska, and I am here today representing our 700 members. Safari Club Alaska supports Senate Bill 10. This bill adds trapping to the already hunting and fishing license for disabled veterans. As our position, this is a small price to pay the people of Alaska, for the people of Alaska to show veterans that our service, that their service is much appreciated. Pretty simple bill, but thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thank you to Senator Keel for introducing it. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sturgeon. Good to see you the other day. All right. Next, we're going to go to Mr. Troy Eck. I believe I pronounced that correctly. State Commander, Veterans of Foreign Wars from the North Pole area.
Yes, sir. I'd like to thank the Senate Resources Committee for allowing me to testify. As stated, I am the state commander for the Veterans of Foreign Wars in Alaska, and I deal with veterans on a daily basis from all over the state. And one of the biggest pluses that veterans recognize in this state is the ability to acquire the hunting and fishing license. And I believe that the added benefit of trapping would get those veterans out in the available areas in Alaska quite a bit more. One of the things that I have mentioned in my letter submitted to Senator Keel was that when veterans can get outside and work on themselves, they become more productive members. Their happiness and, of course, their health is then affected, as is their local community service. Most of these veterans, when they feel good about themselves, they get involved in their community. And just by way of example, I have been a hunting and fishing education instructor. I also work with a couple of different groups here in Alaska, getting veterans out in the woods, hunting and fishing and doing other activities. I think this is, as was stated just a moment ago, a very small token and would mean the world to a lot of veterans in our state.
Okay. Thank you, sir, for your comments, and thank you for what you do for the rest of our veterans in the state. So with that, that'll conclude our invited testimony. Any other committee discussion before we set the bill aside? Seeing none, we're going to set the bill aside, take a brief at ease while we switch presentations. Back on the record, good afternoon, Mr. Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and your trusty aide, Mr. Doug Felkel. We have a nice presentation before us today on the status of the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. So the floor is yours, and I'll kind of monitor the committee. And if I'd like to stop if there's a question at the end of each slide, because instead of stacking them all up at the end. So, thank you.
So, committee members, Chair Bishop, Co-Chair Giesel, and other members of the committee. My name is Doug Vincent Lang. I'm the Commissioner of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I was contacted by Senator Bishop's office to kind of give you a rundown of the status of AYK fisheries, that's Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim River fisheries, a little bit about what we're doing about the situation in the area, and how the governor's budget helps address some of the issues. Sorry, a little hard getting forward.
Yeah, pull that. I know you're wounded there, but pull that mic up there close for you.
So the Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim area is a large area. It basically encompasses everything from the Arctic Ocean down into the Fairbanks region, covers the entire Yukon River drainage, also covers the entire Kuskokwim River drainage, and then all the drainages that flow into the Bering Sea, in the northern Bering Sea, including those in the Nome area. So it's a very large geographic area. And again, first I'm going to kind of start with kind of what we know about the run status of these fisheries, kind of up and down the road, starting with the Yukon River, then going to the Cusco, and then finally a little bit about Norton Sound. And then I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we're doing to address the situation in that area. So. So in the Yukon River, we have a Pacific Salmon Treaty that covers some of the runs of fish that go into the Yukon River. And that's an important consideration, because the state does not have unilateral control of what our passage objectives are into Canada, nor what we can do in terms of management of the fisheries below the Yukon River border, because, again, we have a treaty obligation to pass both fish that are commonly shared between the U.S. and Canada. And those two runs are the king salmon run. About 60% of the run occurs into U.S. waters, and about 40% occurs in Canadian waters. And then the other run that's a treaty-covered fish is the fall run chum salmon, which primarily occurs in the fall season after the summer chum run. And again, there's a split. I think it's about 60% that go into U.S. waters and 40% go into Canada. Both of those, are covered under a Pacific Salmon Treaty obligation. And in both of those cases, we have a panel of which ADF&G is the lead negotiator for the U.S. in federal law. And we set border passage objectives and for both chum salmon and for king salmon. So here's a picture of the Yukon River king salmon drainage-wide total run. As you can see, the last 3 years, we have been well below average in terms of total run numbers, and 2022 was one of the lowest we've seen on record. All evidence is pointing to the fact that we're having poor marine survivals as a cause of this. It doesn't appear to be anything linked to fresh water, but as you'll hear me later, we have some other hypotheses we're chasing down, including fish diseases called ichthyophonus. This gives you an idea of what's happening with the harvest of Yukon River king salmon. The solid bars are the amounts necessary for subsistence, And as you can see, we have not been meeting the amounts necessary for subsistence largely since about 2010. We had 1 year in 2019 where we met them, but largely you'll see that there has been very little harvest opportunity the last 2 years, and we again 2014 and 2015. So it hasn't been that we've been harvesting these fish in other fisheries like commercial fisheries in river or personal use fisheries. The only harvest that you've seen over the last really 10 years has been subsistence harvest in the river, and the production that comes from that has been insufficient to meet the ANS amounts for Yukon River King Salmon.
Commissioner, could you just give us real quick the treaty obligation past the Eagle Sonar?
Yeah, I think I have that here. I think it's 42,500 to 55,000.
Thank you.
So this is Yukon River summer chum salmon. This is not a treaty obligated fish. All these fish spawn in Alaskan waters. But we have treaty considerations when we're managing these fisheries, because these fisheries are typically for subsistence are either prosecuted using fish wheels or gill nets. And when they use gill nets can be fairly indiscriminate. So we have to be very careful in not allowing the incidental harvest of other species like chum salmon, fall run chum salmon or king salmon, which overlap in run timing when we're trying to prosecute these fisheries. But as you can see from this slide, drainage wide escapement, you know, has been high up until about 2020. And then the last 3 years, it has fallen off the cliff. And these were not the result of poor parent year escapements. We had parent year escapements, as you can see back, you know, in time, that were adequate to basically provide a run of about 1.5 million fish. And in 2021, you can see we got about, with no real significant harvest on these fish, we got about 220,000 fish back. So we were missing somewhere on the order of 1.5 million summer chums. And the question is, where did they go? And we're starting to piece that piece together, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. Next slide, please. This is the summer chum harvest, like we did with Yukon River Kings. You can see that what the ANS amount is, and largely, you know, going back in time, we largely met the ANS amounts until 2019, and 2021 and 2022 were severely restricted chum salmon fisheries to meet escapement goals. Next slide. This is fall run chum salmon in the Yukon River. Again, you know, the picture was fairly bright. You know, we were meeting our escapement goal ranges from 2004 through 2019, and everything was looking good. We were providing harvest opportunities for both U.S. and Canada. Then 2020 and 2021 and 2022, it again fell off the cliff. And again, we didn't meet the escapement goal in any of those three ranges. Next slide, please. And this is, again, the subsistence and personal use harvest. You can see the ANS amounts by the solid line. You know, we've largely been kind of near the bottom of that line. There's in years where we haven't had it, but clearly the last 3 years has been well below that line. And that's basically been a loss result of no opportunity to go fishing in that river to meet escapement objectives and king salmon numbers. Next slide, please. So let's switch to the cusk. Oh, before I go into that, I don't have slides yet for coho salmon and other finfish species, but coho salmon have not met the escapement goal the past 3 years in that river, and we've had severely restricted coho salmon fisheries as a result of not meeting escapement objectives. And then for whitefish, a lot of people have been moving towards whitefish and other salmon species like sockeye and pink salmon, as they're not traditional subsistence foods as much as king salmon and chum salmon have been. But we've been seeing more directed effort, especially on whitefish, as we've been providing more opportunity for people to replace food value and try to have food in the freezers and move forward in time. But anecdotal information is suggesting that these fish are starting to show the stresses of both increased harvest and probably reduced production, because whitefish like to feed on salmon eggs and a variety of other things. And as salmon eggs go down, we're seeing, you know, effects on these fish species. Now, sockeye in the Yukon River is not a big run, but like every place else in the Bering Sea, it seems to be sockeye are winning the battle out in the ocean. And so we're seeing more sockeye opportunity kind of popping up throughout the Yukon River drainage, and especially with systems with lakes associated with them. And I suspect over time you'll see more and more sockeye opportunity. So let's switch to the Kuskokwim River. We have for king salmon, we have an escapement goal. As you can see, the upper range and lower range on here, we've been meeting it. Quite a different picture than you have in the Yukon River. We don't have a very good explanation for that, but in this case, we're meeting our escapement goals in that river. Next slide. But we're not meeting the Annis ranges. So you got to look back in time. We kind of adjusted our ANS range, especially in the upper range. But either way, we're not meeting the lower end of this range, even with significantly reduced harvest opportunities. It's not there. We're providing the fish into the escapement, but largely at the expense of subsistence harvest opportunity. That said, we are providing subsistence harvest opportunity on the order of, you can look on the slide, 20 to 30,000 fish. So they're, unlike the Yukon, in this river system, we're providing fish into both the lower and upper river, middle range. And when you look at the lower river, that's basically there's a dividing line between Bethel and Aniak that kind of roughly corresponds to the refuge boundaries that's the lower river. And you'll see most of the subsistence harvest opportunities occurring in the lower river. There's a small amount that's in the upper river. Part of the complication in the Kuskokwim River is the ongoing lawsuit between the United States and the state of Alaska that prohibits us from managing the lower part of the river. And as a result, this past summer, we've had to take fishery restrictions in the upper part of the river because the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service allowed harvest opportunities for lower river uses that we disagreed with, but we couldn't counteract with emergency order authority in season. We also failed to meet a couple upriver escapement goals, which is, if it continues, will be troubling. Next slide. This is chum salmon. As you can see, the Kuskokwim River is seeing the same run failures with chum salmon as we're seeing in the Yukon River drainage. And, we were largely meeting ANS amounts necessary for subsistence in that river up until 2019, and we're seeing a very similar kind of curve in the downward turn of being able to meet subsistence and increased escapement. The bright thing about both the Yukon and the Yukon summer chum and the Kuskokwim River chum salmon is we've seen a bump up in escapement. And if you look back in time, at least on the old slide that I showed for the Yukon, Yukon has had poor summer chum returns in the past and had bounced back from them. We're optimistic that chum salmon are gonna pop back. Whether they're going to pop back sufficient to meet escapement and provide reasonable subsistence harvest opportunities, another question, but at least we're going to be able to meet our escapement goals that hopefully will sustain these runs. Next slide. This is Kuskokwim River coho salmon. Again, we've seen reduced returns from about 2018 through 2022, but in many years we're meeting the ANS amounts for coho in the Kuskokwim River. Next one. And sockeye salmon. Sockeye salmon, again, as I said in the Yukon, they are showing up in greater numbers in the Kuskokwim River. There's some lake systems in the Kuskokwim that are showing increased productivity. And just like in Bristol Bay, we're seeing sockeye salmon win this battle out in the ocean and with climate change. And in this case, we're seeing increased returns, and we're seeing people increasingly relying on sockeye as a subsistence food source and shifting away from chum and Chinook salmon that aren't nearly as available.
Commissioner,
yeah.
Could you confirm this? Sockeye salmon eat a totally different food group than chums and kings and cohos. Is that correct?
Yeah, they're basically planktonic feeders in the ocean. And chum and kings, when they're first out there, they're eating zooplankton, but they, chum and kings will eventually become ichthyosaurs eating other fish. So it's kind of a mystery of what's happening to chum out there. It's not the same food source as sockeye salmon, but one of the thoughts that we have at the department is that, we're now getting 68 million sockeye back to Bristol Bay. To get 68 million sockeye back into Bristol Bay, we're probably putting into the Bering Sea system and the Bristol Bay area that's in near shore waters, they're probably close to 1.8 billion sockeye fry. And they're devouring things that are part of the basic food web for all kinds of fish, including chum and Chinook salmon and crab, amongst a variety of other species. So, and we have high numbers of cod and pollock out there. So those probably are also contributing to it. But clearly, sockeye are winning out there, and clearly, chum and Chinook are not. Next slide. So overall, king salmon have seen reduced productivity this past decade, and chum and coho salmon over the past 3 years. And this has resulted in closed commercial, sport, and personal use fisheries, and severely restricted or closed subsistence fisheries. And this has, you know, I've been out in the, on the villages the last 2 years. I can tell this has really impacted local economies, rural cultures and practices and economies of the villages. The pain is real out there. We get it. We've heard it. We understand it. But we have an obligation to protect these runs and sustain them over time. So the last fish, you know, we have closed commercial, sport, and personal use fisheries in advance of taking any restrictions on subsistence, because we take that subsistence priority seriously. But in cases, some cases, we've also had to restrict subsistence just to ensure that we either meet our treaty obligations or that we're ensuring that we have sufficient fish in the bank to hopefully turn this around. And then on the other hand, sockeye salmon have seen increased productivity, but not commercial opportunities. But commercial opportunities have been limited due to the incidental harvest of Chinook, coho, or chum salmon. So this kind of led the fight between the state and the federal government in the Lower River and the Kuskokwim. The state saw increased opportunities for sockeye harvest, so we opened several sockeye salmon fisheries using very restrictive gear type to allow people to fill their freezers, and the federal government didn't like that decision by the state, so they wanted to preempt us from doing that. Interesting enough, the next year after they preempted us, they did the exact same thing we did in providing it, just that they did it versus the state. So next slide. So what are we doing about this? You know, a lot of people ask me, how are you going to turn this around? Unfortunately, it's not a quick answer. We really don't know what's happening to chum salmon. We really don't know what's happening to Chinook salmon. We have a pretty good idea in freshwater, a lot of the factors that are driving this, but we really don't have a good idea what's happening in the marine waters outside the near coastal area. So in response to the crisis, we've distributed food to communities impacted by the closures. For the last 2 years, we've distributed salmon up and down the coastline to communities that we're seeing that were having food security issues. We recognize that this is not a replacement for the cultural practice of harvesting these fish, but we felt it was important to basically be able to get the fish into people's freezers so they could make it through the winter. And we're working very closely with non-governmental organizations to fill this need if it arises again. Our money to fund this has kind of dried up over the last 2 years, but we work with various NGOs like SeaShare and a group out of Sitka that's run out of there, and we're convinced now that as government steps out of this program, that there's going to be NGOs that come into this program and fill that need as we move forward. We also began a new department, marine science program, to begin unraveling what's happening in the ocean. As almost all the evidence we have from these systems, as well as Chinook salmon across the state, is pointing to the low marine survival and productivity as a cause of what's happening. Similar to what we're seeing in the Yukon, we're in the Copper River, we're seeing production down about to 60% of the value of what it was two decades ago. And we're seeing reduced size at age, which means that a age 1-3 fish has decreased its average length at age by about almost 13-15%. That's a lot, especially when those are females in there and they have fecundity associated with them. So everything is pointing to the fact that king salmon don't like to be in the ocean. They're coming back earlier, they're coming back smaller, and few of them are coming back. So we began a marine science program to start looking at those pieces and start unraveling it. 2 years ago, we hired a lead scientist to run a marine science program. She's been conducting work in the nearshore area in the northern Bering Sea to look at juvenile survival rates of smolts that leave for both chum and Chinook salmon. And we're finding out a lot from that information that we're able to predict what's going to come back in future years from that work. And we're able to look at what some of the limiting factors are and how climate is playing a role in those factors. We also provided funding this last year through I'm the U.S. Salmon Commissioner for Pacific Salmon Treaty. We're provided funding through the Northern Fund, which is a funding source that provides money for treaty, to give $500,000 to International Year of the Salmon. And we provided staff for people to go out on the vessels that Canada and the U.S. had as participating in those surveys, so that we could get a better idea of what's happening beyond that nearshore marine area that we're working on. We also formed a bycatch task force to review the issue of bycatch. A lot of people believe that bycatch is the most significant factor contributing to the low returns. That group has finished its work and has produced its report and given it to the governor. And we can get you a copy of it, but it's on our webpage. There's a lot of good recommendations in there. They really took a close look at it, and they've given us a roadmap of how to proceed forward with bycatch. Specific to one of the recommendations in there is to have the North Pacific Fishery Management Council look at the issue of bycatch of chum salmon particularly and figure out whether a bycatch cap or some other mechanism is appropriate to try to reduce the number of chum salmon that are in the trawl, that are bycaught in the trawl fisheries.
Could you touch on genetics just for a minute on the chum salmon?
Yeah, I will.
I had a conversation. I'd like you to share that with the committee.
Okay, so before I get there, let me finish this one. So what the council has done is formed a work group of the trawl industry as well as affected in-river users from the Yukon and Kuskokwim River drainage to identify a problem statement and identify a range of alternatives to address the issue of chum salmon bycatch. At the April meeting, we plan to hear from them and initiate an analysis at that council meeting that will address this issue. The tricky thing about chum salmon bycatch is, unlike Chinook salmon, almost all the Chinook salmon caught in the Bering Sea are Alaskan origin. Of the chum salmon that are caught in the Bering Sea, a vast majority of them are not Alaskan origin. They're Asian origin hatchery fish. So it's almost on the order of 80% of those are not Alaskan origin fish. So when you do the numbers from that year where we had 200 some thousand fish come back into the, we were missing that year about 1.2 million chum salmon. We could account for somewhere in the order of 20 to 30,000 of those as bycatch in the Bering Sea trawl fishery. It's not the smoking gun I wish it was bycatch was a solution. We could go fix it and be out of this whole thing. But that said, we understand that we should be doing more to address it, so the council's taking those steps moving forward. And included in there is a consideration of whether you have a chum salmon bycatch cap. I know some people feel we're not moving fast enough in that area, but we are very nervous about instituting a bycatch cap on chum salmon that is primarily Asian chum. And right now the fleet has a Chinook salmon bycatch cap that has been instituted, and they're well underneath that cap. And that gives them room to shift from chum salmon into Chinook salmon, which is usually the law of unintended consequences when you do a regulatory move. So we're just being very careful as we move forward so we don't reduce the harvest of Asian chum and increase the harvest of Alaskan Chinook salmon as we move forward. We also worked with industry this last year. We basically told the industry that we're going to take action at the council. We asked them to work voluntarily to figure out ways that they could reduce chum salmon bycatch last year. So they actually instituted through their own voluntary restrictions ways to test fish in areas and move their fleet around. And as a result of that, they had significant reductions in chum salmon bycatch last summer. So those mechanisms are going to help inform council decisions as we move forward. We also worked with fishermen to reduce the harvest of chum salmon in South Peninsula mixed stock fisheries. We know that these chum salmon that leave the Bering Sea spend about a month and a half, 2 months in the northern Bering Sea close to the river mouths. But after that, they kind of head out into the Bering Sea and then head down into the Gulf of Alaska and North Pacific Ocean south of the Alaska Peninsula. So as we have a South Peninsula fishery that primarily targets sockeye salmon, you know, that are heading to Bristol Bay, we harvest some incidental chum salmon in that fishery. So 2 years ago, we got caught off guard as a department. Because of confidentiality, a variety of other things, the harvest was very high. It was 1.2 million in that June fishery, which is a fishery that primarily harvests fish going to coastal western Alaska. And for your coastal western Alaska includes fish from the Bristol Bay drainages, the Kuskokwim River drainages, the Yukon River drainages, as well as Norton Sound drainages. So it's a fairly big complex of fish. But we, because of confidentiality, we kind of wasn't able to keep up with the data. At the end of the data, it was 1.2 million, which was much higher than the historic average. So we told the fleet, again, like we did with the Bering Sea fleet, either figure out a way to get your harvest back down or we're going to do it with Time and Area EO Authority. So last summer, they actually went out and got their harvest through voluntary measures of moving themselves around, doing test fishing and writing other things, down to about 500,000 fish again, which is closer to the long-term average, which was a good thing. Or just real quick, the other thing we did in that fishery is we have a lot of information on genetics from that fishery that was from 10-year-old WASP study. I can't remember what the title stands for, but it's an old genetic study. So we reinstituted genetic studies of the incidental harvest of chum salmon in the South Penn fishery, knowing that this year we have, next month we have a meeting on South Peninsula fisheries, and hopefully that information, we'll have that information available by a board meeting. We'll hopefully show us hot spots spatially and temporally where we can take action to reduce chum salmon that are heading to the AYK region.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Chair Bishop. So Commissioner, just a clarification, you use the numbers 1.2 million and 500,000. Was that the total catch, or was that just the bycatch? And if it wasn't just the bycatch, how do you sort of maintain, where do you get your data on the bycatch numbers specifically in those South Penn fisheries?
So it's not bycatch, it's incidental harvest. Bycatch is when it's a prohibited species. So we've always had incidental harvest in that fishery. It's always been a mixed stock fishery along the South Peninsula fishery. The numbers are from fish tickets, so it's a fairly good index of what's there. But just like in bycatch in the Bering Sea, we know a certain portion of those fish are also, again, coastal Western Alaskan fish, and a certain portion of those fish are Asian fish that they catch that are heading back home. So I don't have all the genetic pieces of it, but we know a large percentage of those fish that are caught in that South Penn fishery are Asian harvested fish, Asian origin fish. Again, the board will have that information available to it when it makes its decisions on how to better regulate or try to reduce the intercepted coastal Western Alaskan chums.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you. Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you. So back to bycatch on the Bering Sea affecting the Yukon. Are those numbers readily available? I kind of want to see where the bycatch, you know, because it was 200,000 Chinook at one point in time, not all of them, of course, being directed to the Yukon River. But are those numbers regularly available to folks?
Yeah, we could get you those information, but they're posted regularly on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council's website, as well as there's been numerous presentations that are posted to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council website. If you look back at the last June meeting, they heard reports from staff as to the composition and numbers of fish caught both in the A season and B season.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And through the chair, you know, looking at the graph from page 3 on the Yukon salmon harvest, you know, it looks like it basically the bottom fell out back in 2008 as far as commercial use, and then it's just never recovered since 2008. Mm-hmm. If we could get the numbers from 2008 forward and from 2008 back, maybe half a dozen years, as far as the bycatch that was anticipated to go through the Yukon during those periods, I think those would be really interesting for me to see.
Yeah, we'd be glad to get that. And if you would like a presentation on what we know about chum salmon, bycatch in the Bering Sea trawl fisheries, we'd be glad to give you one of those presentations too.
And then just one other thing. I know that during those specific dates, the different administrations over the years, especially I know the Obama administration, when I was a member of the House Resources Committee and House Special Committee on Fisheries, they implemented a couple different restrictions on the trawl fleets during those periods. So I know that there were some times that had lower numbers as far as bycatch go for Yukon River destined kings. So if we could get those dates, I just don't remember the dates specifically.
Yeah, I'll try to dig those up. But we'd be happy to give a presentation on management of that trawl fisheries out there. They're readily available, and I know our staff has given them to the Bycatch Task Force. And that's another good, if you're interested, go to the ADF&G website to the Bycatch Task Force, and all the presentations that they received, including that in the Bering Sea trawl industry, is all there. All the numbers are there.
So. Thank you, Commissioner, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
So you can just get that to our office, and we'll distribute his request out to the committee members. And this isn't your... As you know, this won't be your last meeting on fish before this committee. So We'll give you it. We'll take you up on your offer, and we're also going to have the trawl fleet, probably Stephanie Matson and her group, come in and present to us as well. Mr. Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a follow-up based on the last question, if that's all right. So, Commissioner, this issue of the genetics and the Asian origin, I think, is something that isn't well understood in the public. And certainly, I myself, I fished in Prince William Sound, but I didn't realize that was the case in South Penn. And so I'm wondering, that kind of genetic information, how quickly is the department able to get it out to the public, or post it, before the Board of Fish meeting, for example, or the fisheries, the other council's meeting. Do you make that kind of genetic information available to the public?
Yeah, so it's important to realize we have a genetics lab, and National Marine Fisheries Service has a genetics lab. Most of the bycatch piece of it is run by the federal lab, and that's typically about they collect the data, they subsample from the collected data, because a lot of data is collected, and then they basically run those subsamples after the fishery's done. So it's usually the bycatch numbers and genetic pieces of that is delayed by about 6 or 8 months. With the South Penn fishery, we've collected it this year. We ran it. We're going to make it available. I think it might be available right now for informing the board deliberations in February.
Okay.
We made that a priority.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please continue.
We also are developing spend plans for identified fishery disasters, including research as an element of each of these spend plans. I know there's some controversy associated with taking money out of fishermen's hands that were impacted by these things, but as a state, we feel it's important to understand the root causes of these disasters so that we're just not rebuilding the same home caused by the flood damage every year, trying to understand what causes it. We also took an important step this last year. We basically advocated with Congress through our congressional delegation to ensure that communities had access to disaster funds. In the past, we found out that fishermen participate in fisheries and they pay a fish landing tax, and part of that goes back to the community. When there's a disaster and they're not fishing, they're not paying a fish tax, so the community really takes a hit in a lot of the operations. But under the old disaster rules, those communities were not eligible to get disaster relief. So we worked with Congress to make sure that what they would have, their impact is equally eligible for disaster funding as impacts the fishermen themselves. Then we also work with partners to address the science of in-river issues. We're studying ichthyophonus as a factor that's affecting the in-river returns of Chinook salmon. Now, ichthyophonus is a disease that has been around for a long time. It impacts Chinook salmon. Chinook salmon are infected with ichthyophonus eating in the ocean. So it's an ocean. They get it in the ocean, but they're not really impacted at all by it while they're living in the ocean. We don't really understand that. But then once they get into freshwater and their body starts breaking down as they start migrating up the river, the disease becomes more prevalent and more severe and eventually may kill fish, or at least affect their ability to survive and spawn. So we had evidence or had indications that ichthyophonus was a contributing factor. And that evidence came back to the fact that we were passing sufficient numbers of fish at Pilot Station, king salmon at Pilot Station, which is our lower river sonar in the Yukon River, to basically meet our treaty obligations for passage, which we measure with the sonar at the Eagle River at the border of the Yukon River. But we were missing like 40% of the fish. So these fish are either dying from something or they're being illegal harvested or a variety of other things. We kind of ruled out illegal harvest. We didn't think that level of illegal harvest was occurring, although some fish probably were harvested. But we became aware through talking to people out in the river that they were starting to see more and more diseased fish. So we actually instituted a study beginning this year where we sample fish at Pilot Station, and then we sample fish at the rapids, which is kind of right above the Fairbanks where the Nanana comes in, and then also up at Eagle River Sonar. And we're looking at the prevalence of the disease and the severity of the disease as we move upriver. And we're finding, in fact, that these fish, there's an increased prevalence as you move upriver, and severity increases as you move upriver. And it seems to be at least one of the factors that's affecting our ability to pass fish and meet our Canadian border obligations. That became a bit controversial last year because Canada didn't like us taking, 400 fish to study this when we're talking about at the low escapements we are, but we actually pushed back and actually reduced our sample size, but continued that study, because if we don't know how many fish we're losing between those two sections of the river to the Ictiophonus, it's very hard to negotiate a passage escapement number. We're also beginning we understand there's a real desire to have a mid-river sonar someplace in that river. Sonars require a lot of work to figure out what the right place is to put them. And one of the things we're doing this year is we've instituted a radio telemetry study. So we're going to put radio tags into fish at pilot station. We're going to track where they're going and what banks they're using how their moving pattern is moving up towards through the rapids area, especially in that Fairbanks area, to determine whether we want to put a sonar below the Nanana, above the Nanana. Where's the best place to put this rather than try to invest a lot of money in putting one out and finding out it's the wrong place? We're also beginning a study of fall chum near the border to determine in-river factors affecting survival. So summer chum seem to be rebuilding, but fall chum don't seem to be rebuilding. So something's happening, with chum salmon in that upper river. So we're looking at a river system in Alaska, the Porcupine, and we're looking at one in Canada. And we're going to compare survival and impacts to different fish in both those river systems. We're also working with the Board of Fish in Canada on options to provide a limited number of salmon for culture camps. I just attended the AYK board meeting, and there was a lot of concern about losing culture. And I get that. Culture is the fabric of being able to take your kids out, be at camp, harvest fish. There's a food security issue, but there's a whole different issue in just passing on those traditions of hunting and fishing and having families together in the river. So I actually challenged the board and the group to look at, let's say summer chum, we were able to meet our escapement goals this year, but not have a full-scale chum salmon fishery. Is there some way we could give, through educational permits, some number of fish that would have a culture camp in each one of these communities up and down the river, and how the affected communities would distribute those fish between themselves to ensure that there was some kind of, ability to get out and touch fish. Touching fish was critically important.
Thank you for that. Representative Kronk and I called you about an idea similar to this, and I'd like to thank you for taking it to this point. We spent over a week on the river, five different villages at one time, but it's serious. We're losing the lifestyle, and you recognize that. So appreciate this effort here on this bullet.
Okay, then we are working with with Canada on ideas for rehabilitation via hatcheries in the Yukon. There's a lot of experience with hatcheries across the Pacific Northwest with Chinook salmon, and many of those have not turned out very positively, especially in the Columbia River. So we're a little nervous as a state of just jumping into this without doing some work up front. I also talked to the Yukon River panel, which is the treaty panel on the U.S. side, and I said, what's your what would you like to do with hatcheries? And there is not uniform support to do rehabilitation through hatcheries through that panel. But there are some groups. And part of the problem is that your support for a hatchery depends upon whether you benefit from it or not. So if you put a hatchery in Fairbanks, nobody above Fairbanks really benefits from that hatchery. So there's not a lot of support above Fairbanks to have a hatchery support. And then depending upon how that hatchery provides fish in potentially into Fairbanks, it would have to be some kind of marked select fishery so that you didn't increase harvest rates on Canadian origin fish, which is what happened in the Columbia River. As you produced hatchery fish, you increased harvest rates on wild fish, which further drove down wild fish. So we've came up with the idea of actually talking to Canada about putting a rehabilitation hatchery in Canada. Unfortunately, about a year ago, they had a major fire in Canada at their hatchery at the Whitehorse Dam there. So we're still talking to them, and they haven't ruled out the concept of putting a hatchery up in Fairbanks that would provide benefits for fishermen up and down the river. So that would be the ideal location. We're also open to suggestions on how to do in-river incubation boxes for salmon. I know that was tried in the Norton Sound area. People want to bring us permits to do that, we'll be glad to permit it. We've had limited success with it as an option, but if CDQ groups or other people want to try that in the Cusco or in the North Sound, Yukon, we'd be open to it. We'd be willing to look at permitting it. We're also working with our federal partners to leverage infrastructure and build back American dollars. Finally, after 3 years, the federal agencies now are starting to they figured out how they want to spend the money. And we were approached by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on some ideas in the Yukon River and how we could invest into things that would help unravel the complexities of why these fish aren't returning. And then lastly, I'm going to add that the cooperation in the Kuskokwim River is really hindered by the U.S. government's lawsuit against the state of Alaska on jurisdictional issues. We feel strongly as a state that this is a pretty important fight to fight. You know, we fought statehood over the right to manage our fish and game resources. In the Kuskokwim River, it's a navigable waterway. We feel we have that right. And I just want to also add that this is important from a philosophical point of view, too, because many people that may have grown up in Bethel, including Alaska Natives, may be displaced into Anchorage or Fairbanks for social economic reasons, health reasons. The Alaska Native Hospital is in Anchorage. Those people under federal rules are precluded from fishing. And we would like to have the opportunity for those people to go out and participate, and they can do that under state regulations. So we are fighting this, but at the same time, we're making sure that to the extent possible, as we fight this fight, we can continue to provide subsistence uses out in that river. Next slide.
Vice Chair,
that's it.
Sure. Thank you. Commissioner, you were talking about a hatchery in Fairbanks. There is a hatchery in Fairbanks, a very expensive one, as I recall. Is it? I visited. It seemed to be functioning. Can you tell me more about that?
So that's a sport fish hatchery. It was paid for under sport fish bonds, paid for by sport fishermen. So it becomes a little hard to use that hatchery to produce fish for subsistence when subsistence fishermen haven't paid for the construction of the hatchery. So, but and right now that hatchery is at full capacity. They just reinstituted grayling, which they cut several years ago. So there's not a lot of capacity at that hatchery.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. Back to the bycatch issue. This mm-hmm. legislature, I think it was in the Senate side, the Senate Fish and Game Budget Subcommittee, where they added funding specifically to study bycatch on the Yukon, the YK area. And it was subject to the governor's veto. The governor vetoed that $1.5 million. You're aware of that, right?
Last year?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll let you finish.
It was something that the Senate had decided. I think it was the Senate that added it in, right? Or it wasn't the House.
So the YRFDA, Yukon River Fisheries Drainage Association, they were, I think, on $1.2
million. Okay. Yeah. So do you want to know why that was vetoed?
That wasn't vetoed, though.
Okay.
It was a Kuskokwim.
Yeah. So there was a belief that we were going to be able to answer within in the immediate future, is my understanding, that the origin of chum salmon from the Cusco, from the Yukon, and from the North and South areas would be differentiated through this money. As recently as a year ago, both Fish and Game and the NOAA Lab looked at that question extensively, and we were not able to answer that question. So we didn't think it was inappropriate to answer the questions that were being asked. We decided it was premature until we had a little bit more time to get to this science between being able to differentiate those numbers. Currently, we have numbers on chum salmon bycatch, and we currently are collecting numbers on the coastal Western Alaska versus Asian chum distribution. But we cannot, at this point in time, differentiate between those different systems in within coastal Western Alaska. And this study was trying to get at that question, but best I could tell, even our geneticist and NOAA geneticist said we couldn't get there. And the other thing they were trying to do is put in, my understanding was, a onboard ship program to kind of monitor this, and similar to what we do in Bristol Bay. But again, there was a lot of technological issues that would have not got you there at this point in time. There was needed to be some foundational science first. So it's not that we're not collecting the science without that money. We're still collecting the science that we had and we've been collecting over the last 10 years.
So, Chair, thank you. So the $1.2 million, I think I wrote down $1.4 million, what would that have gone to? And how would it have improved the study? Or are you saying that it wouldn't have improved the study at all?
That's what we felt. When we looked at it, it was based on the assumption that we could find the differential contribution of coastal Western Alaska by stream system, which we couldn't do. We're believe me, we are looking for that magic genetic sequence that will differentiate Yukon from Bristol Bay from Yukon River salmon. But this was kind of assuming that they could solve that, and between our two labs, we couldn't solve it at this point in time. And there was an assumption, I'm trying to remember this, that we were going to be able to do this in season to give this assessment in season as to what the, on a certain portion's catch, what the catch was for that daily trawl. The way the trawl industry works out there is they're trawling and they offload to a ship, either onshore or onto a mothership. A lot of trawls are intermixed, so this was trying to get to a question that would have required a lot more thought and design prior to spending that money on that question. So I can sit down and talk to you more about it.
Sure. And just I know that the $1.4 million could have maybe been utilized over a number of years to get to that answer, but I think that the sooner we get to an answer, I think the better. I don't know if the department is willing to consider looking at that as a potential out in future years for the people of the Yukon.
Yeah. Believe me, we are looking, as we collected chum salmon this year in South Penn Fishery, that staff is working to try to figure out whether they can find the right sequence to determine which of those are Bristol Bay chum, which of those are Yukon chum, which are coastal Kuskokwim chum, because clearly, some instances, Bristol Bay chum are doing much better than the other chum runs. So if we can distinguish between those runs, we can better target our actions to reduce the right chum harvest in the South Penn fisheries.
And just if it is a question of not having the resources or not having the science or not having the ability to get folks out there to do that, mm-hmm. and it does require funding, then the legislature ought to know.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Anything else?
Yeah. When you're done.
I'm done. I'm done.
Okay. So a couple things for me. Do you think I get a lot of from the interior from some fishermen and a processor that they talk about and have given me volumes of information on hatchery fish. Mm-hmm. They contend that the hatchery fish are in competition with these salmon for feed in the ocean. And have you found any merit to that?
We are looking at the question of hatchery releases on straying into natural systems. There are other work being done to look at the impact of hatchery fish in the open ocean on Chinook salmon. There's a lot of factors that potentially affect Chinook salmon in the open ocean. That hatchery food sources may be one of them. It might just be changes in temperature. As the temperature warms, they require more food to eat, and the food they're eating is less nutritious. So it becomes this losing battle where they basically go down in size. Are they being outcompeted by sockeye salmon, chum salmon, hatchery fish? We don't know that answer. It's probably a complex system of variables affecting it. We know marine mammals are affecting the number of fish that are leaving these systems. In Southeast Alaska, we know, for instance, that some studies are showing that number of marine mammals has almost increased tenfold over the last two decades with the Marine Mammal Protection Act, again, which is an act that basically manages marine mammals at the expense of the rest of the ecosystem. You're going to have the maximum number of marine mammals. Optimal numbers of marine mammals, and we've been suggesting for years that we ought to change the Marine Mammal Protection Act to make marine mammals a functional part of the ecosystem rather than at the expense of the ecosystem. But marine mammals are definitely having an effect. They're eating in Southeast Alaska and potentially in the Bering Sea. We're seeing a lot more marine mammals. They're eating herring, which are important to Chinook salmon to eat. So temperature, the quality of the food, competition, they're probably all variables in the ocean.
I started digging into this hatchery question a little bit. It's, we got our hatcheries here in the state, but if you go Google and look at hatcheries in Kamchatka Peninsula, Japan, and China, there's a lot of hatcheries. Yeah. Senator Kawasaki.
Yeah, just on the hatchery question too, we've talked about this in prior years. You're familiar with carrying capacity for potentially like moose,
right,
ungulates and things like that, where they say they have just a certain, because there's just a certain number of moose that balance out the certain forage available. Wouldn't it be just practically thinking something that is similar to that when it comes to the total biomass of fish that are hatchery based, that are produced in a very limited ocean instead of a forest?
Yeah, I think there's thoughts like that, but then again, the ocean's a very big ocean, and when we go out and look in the ocean, for instance, the International Year of the Salmon, to catch salmon out there, we lay a long gill net and we catch very few salmon. So I think it depends upon where in the ocean you are, and we don't know enough yet to answer that question to know whether hatchery fish and wild fish are in the same area of the ocean, basically to be competing. We just don't have that piece together yet. The International Year of the Salmon started answering those questions. That's why we saw value in participating in it. And there's, I can't remember what the new group is that's inherited that, but they're going to continue that research because you need to understand the distribution of fish out there and whether hatchery fish and wild fish are coexisting, and then look at some of the, as you catch some of these fish, look at, are the hatchery fish better off than the wild fish? We just don't have that answer yet.
Just to follow up, I guess if this is a question that we need to know the answer to, then is there has the department requested funding to make that study happen, or gone through the university sources or other folks within the International Year of the Salmon?
So we found money without having to come to you guys for money. We found money through the North Pacific Research Board. We gave $500,000, and through Pacific Salmon Treaty, $500,000. So we contributed $1 million towards that effort last year. Right now, there's no effort underway, and the state can't really lead that effort independently. It needs to be an international effort between Russia, Japan, probably Canada and the United States. And again, that last year we had that study that Canada did the Eastern Gulf, U.S. did the Middle Gulf, and we had plans to cooperate with Russia until Ukraine happened. And Russia did the other side, and we didn't stay in those vessels. So.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll say just a comment first for my question is that, $1 million is a lot of money in certain contexts, but relative to the size of this catastrophe, it does seem like the federal government, the state government, all of us should, can we find more money to really focus on this? It's just the size of the catastrophe is so much larger, I think, than that sum of money. But my question is about, the hatchery question is an interesting one, of course, bycatch as well. But my question is sort of what changed, right? So it was going along relatively steadily, and then in 2008, you have this sort of beginning of a collapse in the Yukon River King here, and then 2019, 2020, you have these other collapses. Mm-hmm. And so I thought that, were there large new hatcheries that opened in Asia, for example, or not? Or maybe it's 7 years earlier, were there a new kind of fleet that came online? What have you been able to identify at all that sort of changed at those different points?
So I wish it was as easy as one identifier. As I told a hearing the other day, I said, I wish it was bycatch because I could go out and solve that. There is no single smoking gun out there. The number of hatchery releases, kind of grew steadily in the 1980s, but there hasn't, in the last 10 years, there hasn't been a significant increase in the number of hatchery releases going out globally. So that, it wasn't like all of a sudden 5 years ago we saw a doubling of the hatchery releases into the ocean and all of a sudden we're seeing an end. We do know the ocean's warming, and as the ocean warms, that changes the phytoplankton and zooplankton complexities out there. It appears that some fish species are able to capitalize on that. Cod and pollock are doing really well in that kind of an environment. Crab, not so well, and some salmon species, not so well. Why? We really don't know. We're trying to piece it together. But our program to date, up until about 2 years ago, really centered on ensuring that we got fish into the river. We managed commercial fisheries at the front end of it. to provide subsistence and escapement, and we really focused all our efforts in the in-river system. When I came in 4 years ago, I recognized that we better start looking out in the marine environment. So we instituted this marine science program. We're starting to answer the question near shore. The governor's budget has money to expand that science program into the southern Bering Sea outside the Kuskokwim River in the Bering Sea area, as well as South Peninsula area, and then down in southeast Alaska, so we can start getting some comparative information from those other areas. But clearly, it's a lot harder to piece together a research plan for the open ocean, because it's a big ocean, and we don't have the ships alone to go out and do that work. And NOAA's got vessels that can do it, but it's very expensive work that needs to be carefully thought out and designed before we just go spend millions of dollars out there to climb it. But clearly something is happening in the ocean. Next time I come in, I'll show you a graph in the Copper River. Again, I said that earlier in this presentation. The Copper River was hooking along at about, I think it was about 65,000 fish production. And then all of a sudden, at about 1989, it just shifted down and went down to about 42, and it's never gone back up. It's just, now it's a lower level of production, but over that entire time, the size of those fish has decreased. Again, when you look at decreased size at age, and you look at decreased productivity, and you look at the fact that these fish are no longer coming back as 1.5s and 1.6s, they're coming back as 1.3s and 1.4s, pointing to the ocean not being a great place to be.
Senator Giesel?
Commissioner, 10 years ago, the Senate, I think the House also was part of this, we had the Arctic Policy Commission. Mm-hmm. And we talked, of course, about subsistence and food security. And one of the things we talked about and speculated on was the ocean warming and our fisheries moving north. So a few weeks ago, maybe even a month ago, I saw an article about folks in Kaktovik finding salmon mm-hmm. in their area. Was that a true story?
Oh, yeah. Fish are prospecting their way across the Arctic North now. So all those streams are starting to see salmon. Starting to see moose, too. Somebody out of Barrow took a moose this last year. Things are moving around in this new ecosystem and new changes.
Just a follow-up comment. I've read reports of northern Canada also seeing salmon. Mm-hmm. Just very interesting.
Yeah. So one other thing the governor's budget has in it is to put some money in to start at the state level looking at the Arctic, because we have the Arctic state law that guides Arctic policy, and we have a moratorium in place on Arctic fishing that's going to last about another 4 years. It's pretty clear to me that Russia is not going to wait very long after that moratorium to have fisheries, so I think it's time for us to start now to figure out what a responsible fishery looks like, at least in U.S. waters.
Other questions from committee members? I'd just like to a couple of wrap-up comments, but, you know, we've all sat in a lot of meetings for the last several years, especially this summer, both at the state level, tribal level, federal level. If there was an easy fix, like you said, you would have fixed it. But I agree with my comments around the table. I mean, I'm not going to we've got to bring all assets to bear to figure this out. And I just don't want to let I hope we don't lose the genetics mm-hmm. on our Yukon River co-host, our king salmon, excuse me, Chinook. That's a once-in-a-lifetime gift that the good Lord gives us. We can't lose those genetics.
Well, I want to assure you that there's talk, you know, about listing these species in the Yukon River. These species are far from going extinct. Yeah, they're not providing for subsistence harvest opportunities, but we're still talking about tens of thousands of fish that are in these river systems. So a listing, when I talk to people about a listing would result in no directed take of that fish species. Now think about that for a second. That means that if you're on the river and all of a sudden you meet the lower end of the escapement goal, but it's a listed species, you can't have directed take until you meet the recovery objectives for that species. That means subsistence and directed take to feed your family is no longer allowed, but incidental take is allowed. So you could theoretically have a situation where you have the incidental take of Chinook salmon allowed in the Bering Sea, but no directed harvest allowed in rivers. So we do not believe that this, any of these species, even though they have low productivity rates right now, are at risk of extinction and need to be listed under that law and federalized. That will federalize the management of that species.
All right. Any other further committee discussion before we wrap up? Thank you, Commissioner. We've got we're going to take your offer on the rest of the fisheries. We're going to have conversations about the remainder of the fisheries around the state. I know there's several people here at the table that like to go down to the Copper River and dip net, and they're concerned about, want to hear the return numbers on that fishery as well as the rest of the state, Bering Sea crab. We know that season's closed, and
one of my harder decisions as commissioner.
Yeah, well, it's not easy being a commissioner. So with that being said, thank you. Our next meeting is Monday, January 30th at 3:30 p.m. And on our agenda will be Cook Inlet Gas Update, Department of Natural Resources, and Chair Giesel will conduct that meeting. So with that, we are done at 4:45 and 4:42. We're adjourned.